There is no soundtrack in a real war.
This is really the hardest time. You know, there really hasn't been any kind of return to normalcy in the Army. You go to Iraq or Afghanistan and you come home, and then you spend a short period of time trying to reintegrate with your family. And really what units are doing after that is getting ready to go again.
With the shooting this week of four U.S. soldiers in Iraq by another U.S. soldier comes the reminder that the war in Iraq is not in the past and is not even over. Baghdad down in the public's mind.
Hey, baby, it's me. You there? Pick up if you're there.
Baghdad not out. War is not an issue. War is war. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, May 13th. I'm John Hockenberry, joined today by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hello, John. Now, coming up this morning, we're going to take a look at the psychological stress on active duty soldiers. In light of Monday's shooting, we're also going to look ahead to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing today on the so-called torture memos. We're also going to continue our graduation series. It takes a look at the challenges that college grads are facing in these economic times. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, some violent news from Afghanistan. A suicide bomb killed at least seven people today outside a U.S. military base in Khost. At least 21 others are injured. That's the same area where gun battles broke out after militants stormed government buildings yesterday. Pope Benedict is making his first official visit to the West Bank today. He says the Palestinians have a right to a homeland.
I know how much you have suffered and continue to suffer as a result of the turmoil that has afflicted this land for decades.
The Pope also called on Palestinians not to resort to violence and terrorism in their fight for an independent state. He'll visit a refugee camp later today. The space shuttle Atlantis is expected to latch onto the Hubble Space Telescope today to begin a week's worth of repairs. The mission will continue in spite of damage that occurred to the Atlantis's heat shield during its launch on Monday. Farai?
An aide to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected to testify today before the Senate on the so-called use of torture. Philip Zelico, is expected to talk about internal debates within the Bush administration about whether simulated drowning and other extreme practices were illegal. In a 2005 memo, he wrote some of the tactics violated the Constitution. President Obama is also going to meet with Senate leaders today to discuss his nominee for the Supreme Court. He wants the pick to get through the Senate vetting process before Congress breaks in August. And we're going to talk more about Sri Lanka, and the only hospital in Sri Lanka's war zone was shelled today, killing 15 people. That's according to a doctor at the facility. We don't have independent confirmation on that. The military denies using heavy artillery in its most recent push against the Tamil Tigers.
Today marks the last of five phases of voting in India's general election. 107 million people are eligible to cast their ballots today. Results should be announced on Saturday. Big economic indicator later this morning, retail sales. They were down more than 1% in March. We'll know about April. The Dow and the S&P were mostly flat yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 9:08. 1.6 million people are graduating this year from college. Are you one of them? What are you going to tell your grandchildren about these economic times we live in? Story's not over, right? Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We begin with noting the stress of war that is still continuing over in Iraq and Afghanistan. More details are emerging about the soldier who allegedly killed five of his fellow Americans in Baghdad on Monday. And we're learning about the victims. Associated Press is reporting the names of three of the victims. We've got Commander Charles Springle, a clinical social worker from Wilmington, North Carolina, who had served in the Navy for 21 years. Dr. Matthew Hauseel, a psychiatrist from Amarillo, Texas, who had reportedly volunteered to go back to assist in Iraq, was called up for duty. And a 19-year-old soldier from Federalsburg, Maryland, named Michael Edward Yates, Jr. The shooter, The alleged shooter, Sergeant John M. Russell, had recently been relieved of his weapon by commanding officers. We learned that, and on Monday, though it didn't matter, he reportedly wrestled a weapon away from an officer who was escorting him away from a mental health clinic. Then he went back to the clinic and opened fire. Russell's father, Wilburn Russell, told Texas TV station WFAA on Tuesday that his son was hurt rather than helped by the examiners in the Baghdad clinic where he allegedly opened fire.
They ruined your life. They told him, you're an idiot. You don't belong in here. We're going to break you. We're going to get you out of here. Well, that's what the stress test technicians were telling him. They just follow orders. You know, I don't know if they had a psychologist in the room with him.
Well, we're taking a look at the impact of the almost unimaginable psychological stress on servicemen and women with Major Dina Brager, who heard her voice at the top of the hour there. She's executive officer to the Dean of West Point. She's a social psychologist who served in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. And the history of these kinds of incidents, so-called soldier-on-soldier violence in the U.S. military, Paul Springer is joining us. He's a professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Both of our guests are at West Point. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So there was a lot of information there. I just wanted to get people caught up with the details. But basically, this goes straight to the gut, Dina. The stresses that are going on in theater in Baghdad, in Iraq, and Afghanistan right now don't diminish just because the visibility of the war diminishes, correct?
No, John. In fact, one of the things that's been really telling in the mental health research that we've done the last few years in the Army is that most soldiers who come out of the war maybe after one assignment or two without post-traumatic stress disorder or some form of stress symptoms, after that third deployment, there's a relatively high number of folks who just have pretty significant mental health challenges, you know, just from coming off a third deployment. So really, as the war's gone on, the mental health challenges have significantly increased.
You know, some of the details, Major, of this particular incident motivate some questions about the actual clinical environment there in Baghdad. I mean, this occurred at a clinic.
Yeah.
If you listen to the father, apparently this was a retaliation against the clinicians.
Yeah.
We don't know if that's true or not. What kind of pressure are the clinicians under in a situation like this?
I mean, unfortunately, I was in this situation as a commander even back in 2003 where folks, you know, were under enough stress and not doing well enough that you needed to bring them to a clinic to seek help. So, gosh, it brings me right back there.
I can hear it.
To a few years ago. And, I just think this is such a tough situation. Like, if you're a commander and you're responsible for, you know, the good order and discipline of your unit, and you're responsible for caring for, you know, a number of soldiers, maybe, you know, 150 or 200, you have to make decisions based on, you know, what's good for the unit and the individual. And then, you know, you bring a soldier down to a mental health clinic where they're not necessarily bonded with the clinicians and they don't necessarily have a repetitive, trusting relationship with them. But you, as a commander, really need a professional to make a decision on mental health fitness that you're not necessarily qualified to make. So you, as a commander, are relying on the mental health officials. The mental health officials are really trying to do their jobs and support both the soldier and the Army, because really they're charged with, you know, taking care of the individual and making sure that they're fit to be under stressful conditions. So,
right. Well, I mean, it's also a decision that could end the career of any soldier, and a lot of people in Iraq are career military. Paul Springer, let's talk a little bit about the historical context of incidents of these types. I mean, the number of deployments is, in some sense, historically unprecedented, at least in the modern era of warfare in the United States. But go back a little farther. Where does this fit?
Well, quite frankly, it's not as unprecedented as you might suggest. If you look at the type of combat deployments, say from World War II, you had individuals that were in continual combat for more than a year in the European theater, for a lot more than that, really in the Pacific theater, of island after island after island being assaulted. In Vietnam, you had repeated deployments for some individuals, for people that had chosen the Army for their career. So you had a lot of officers that had repeated deployments and a lot of non-commissioned officers that had repeated deployments. It's really only the conscripted enlisted personnel who were doing 1 year of service in Vietnam and then being released from service.
Paul, this is Farai. There is the term fragging, and in Vietnam, there were many incidents of people killing their commanders, for example.
Sure.
One case that I've heard about personally involved troops that were going to be sent on a suicide mission, and instead they just killed their commander in Vietnam. There have been some allegations that has occurred in Iraq, but I have not heard anything substantiated. But what is the... You know, the military runs on an incredible reliance of discipline and chain of command. How does that break down, when you look at historical examples? When does that break down?
Sure. In the case of Vietnam, there really is a massive breakdown that occurs. Really, 1969 is kind of the breaking point for Vietnam when it comes to a massive rise in fragging incidents, a massive rise in soldier-on-soldier violence. And what it really boils down to is a disconnect between the stated mission of the military forces and the actual performance of that mission. So in the case of Vietnam, after the Tet Offensive, when American soldiers had been told that the war was going well, that everything was being successful, that we were making progress, and then they're suddenly surprised by a massive attack by hundreds of thousands of enemy troops that's coordinated against every major southern Vietnamese city, they begin to realize that, in fact, maybe the military leadership is either unaware of what's going on or is being deceptive about the current situation.
Wow.
And when they start to feel that disconnect, when they feel like their leadership isn't looking out for their best interests, that's when you start to see a breakdown in morale.
Well,
the breakdown in morale leads to a breakdown in discipline.
Well, let's explore that disconnect from our own perspective here, Dina Brager. Is there a disconnect in that the Iraq war is kind of out of the headlines and there's a sense that it's winding down because that's the policy of the Obama administration? And does that have the effect of increasing stress or a sense of isolation?
Sir, I don't really think people in the military feel that way. I really do think that the stress is just so much, and still in the military, unfortunately, there's a stigma about getting mental health care. And obviously, if you're deployed and you're busy every day and going on missions and kind of doing your job in Baghdad, there's not a whole lot of time for you to sit down and reflect and kind of take time out and go get mental health care and work through some of that when you're actually in theater. So I really do think that the stress continues. I think American soldiers feel like people know they're over in Iraq and Afghanistan and that they're working hard. I just think they're under such conditions that, you know, there's really not been a break for a number of years. And as these multiple deployments continue, and of course, I don't know if Sergeant Russell's on a first deployment, second or third, but I guess I really don't think that matters as much as there are just some significant stressors that people are under. And, you know, it's hard to take care of that all in theater.
Well, Dina, I mean, forgive me, but I really kind of have to ask this. I mean, how do you tell a soldier who you know is under this stress in theater at a clinic like this one that Russell was at to hold on, help is on the way, when maybe in your gut you don't know if that's even true?
Well, I mean, I think as a commander, that may be of why his commander even sent him to the clinic. I mean, you know, what does happen is if the doctors determine that it would be in your best interest to go back to the States or not be there, they'll make that decision, and that's what will happen. So a lot of times if you're a commander and you feel like a soldier's really suffering and not doing well to the point of maybe needing to go home, this would be the procedure that you'd follow.
Paul, before we go, what do you think Americans need to know about this to set it in context, to either not be too alarmist or to cast a sort of a broad verdict on soldiers in the Iraq War?
Quite frankly, from a historical standpoint, it's still extremely, extremely, extremely rare. Soldier-on-soldier violence, thankfully, is something that does not happen on a regular basis. It's not an epidemic of violence. It is the exception to the rule. And that was true in Vietnam as well.
Right.
The vast majority of soldiers in Vietnam did not engage in any of this type of behavior.
Well, we're grateful it's an exception. Nevertheless, the story is upsetting, and I thank both of you for helping us to set it in context. Paul Springer, professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and Major Dina Brager, executive officer to the dean of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Both were at West Point. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.